got a sprain or an itch, pain, rash, swelling, or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. 3 days ago, I came across an article lamenting the choice, or I should say, absence of a choice of physician to be a part of the Biden-Harris Coronavirus Task Force. Of course, there were the arrays of infectious disease and public health experts chosen.
The author of the article lamented that no mental health professional, such as psychiatrists, was among those recommended to be on the force.
And again, according to the author, not having a single behavioral health provider on the task force will likely prove to be a mistake that could affect millions of Americans. You see, although COVID-19 is certainly an infectious disease, it affects both individuals and groups, as well as society as a whole, in a number of ways. School-aged children, for example, have already missed the social aspects of school for many months.
And do not forget those elderly in the nursing homes and hospitals and extended care facilities, some who were unable to see, touch, and even hear from friends, family, and their own healthcare providers.
Multiple studies have already and continue to roll in showing that patients with COVID-19 can present during and after infection with neuropsychiatric symptoms.
These symptoms include delirium, psychosis, and anxiety.
In July, a meta-analysis published in The Lancet regarding the neuropsychological outcomes of earlier diseases caused by coronavirus, such as severe acute respiratory syndrome and Middle East respiratory syndrome, better known as MERS, have suggested that in the short term, close to a quarter of the patients experienced confusion representative of delirium. And in the long term, those who suffered from the symptoms of COVID-19 following recovery frequently reported emotional lability, impaired concentration, and traumatic memories.
The medical magazine, The Lancet, showed that rates of psychiatric disorders, dementia, and insomnia are significantly higher among survivors of COVID-19.
So, overall, the pandemic has been associated with significantly increased rates of anxiety and depression symptoms. Again, these neuropsychiatric symptoms are not only seen in those who actually had the disease, but in virtually anyone affected by the changes to the social norms that we are all accustomed to. We, as living beings, are a gregarious species, more so than most.
There is much downstream consequences of the damage to the American people's psyches when planning how our system can adapt to ensure that there is access to care and treatment.
This is especially true when you consider the following. First, consider this. It is truly very difficult to diagnose and treat mental health symptoms in a primary care setting that is already overburdened. There has been, is, and will continue to be delayed treatment and increased cost of all the sequelae of COVID-19.
Just because we now may have several vaccines that can help prevent COVID-19 does not mean that everything goes back to normal immediately.
For many, it will never go back to normal. The damage to people and their relationships to others could be permanently altered. Just look at the other events that have occurred in 2020, including those who suffered from the first fires, the major fires across the country, the highest number of damaging hurricanes that have hit our country, the racial unrest, the children out of school, the loss of jobs, and even the recent election.
So in order to try to help our citizens, we really do need that the coronavirus task force has psychiatric experts as an integral part of the task force.
Let's look at some statistics. There are over 8 million yearly doctor's visits for depression, and over half of those are in the primary care setting. Actually, fewer than half of those patients leave with a diagnosis of depression or are even treated for it.
Remember that many of the symptoms of depression and anxiety mimic other diseases. These symptoms can include non-specific physical complaints such as digestive problems, headaches, insomnia, or general aches and pains.
And even without the coronavirus affecting our population, screening alone has not been an effective strategy, especially when certain groups are less likely to be screened. These include older adults and minorities. Many of these are at higher risk for mortality after COVID-19.
Even before the pandemic, you could say that the mental health system was and still is most likely even more so than before. Inadequate for those who are currently diagnosed with mental disorders.
Parents who have lost their jobs or whose income is now so low that they're worrying about how they will continue to feed their children. Individuals with insurance faced difficulty finding psychiatrists and psychotherapists who took insurance or who were available to accept new patients. Now, the growing shortage of providers in general is even greater. Community health centers are having problems due to funding decreases in both federal and state monies.
Even those individuals, or we could say especially those persons with substance use, face few options for the outpatient, residential, or pharmacologic treatment that many needed to maintain sobriety.
It's a fact that with the pandemic, we have seen rates of anxiety, depression, and even suicidal thinking increasing among adults and youth, while many clinics have been forced to lay off employees, reduce services, and even close their doors.
So as a result of the pandemic itself, plus the events of this year, mental health providers are already warning not only of the current trauma underlying our day-to-day lives, but also that of years to come.
One study found that 81% of behavioral health providers began using telehealth for the first time in the past 6 months, again, owing to the COVID-19 pandemic. And not just mental health care providers, but many others, such as health care providers, have found that telehealth is the only way to provide care at this time.
And yet, many insurance companies are actually making it difficult for healthcare workers to get paid, with a great many insurance companies denying payment for the healthcare services provided.
Just ask most physicians what their opinion of health insurance companies is. And believe me, it has worsened over the months of the pandemic.
Speaking of the pandemic, last week, Dr. Lasky and I presented to our listeners some of the main medications that are now or have been made available to not only healthcare workers, but the general public to treat COVID-19 infections.
Today, we're going to continue the show by attempting to present all the rest of the medications that we could not get to last week. I promise you that we'll try to make it interesting as well as informative, and we hope that we succeed. Let's start with something called convalescent plasma. Now, this may not be a new procedure, since around a century ago, doctors filtered plasma from the blood of recovered flu patients. This convalescent plasma happens to be rich with antibodies, and it has, in the past, helped people sick with flu fight their illness.
Recently, tens of thousands of patients in the U.S. have received plasma through a program launched by the Mayo Clinic and federal government.
Like most of the treatments that we've heard about, experts as well as non-experts on both sides have expressed their opinions. In August, some government scientists reportedly stopped the FDA from giving emergency authorization to convalescent plasma, stating that there was just not enough evidence of the efficacy of the treatment. Then in the same month, President Trump announced that the authorization would go through.
At that point, the NIH's COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel underscored the importance of further investigation on convalescent plasma's effectiveness.
Even a Mayo Clinic's program suggested that the treatment provided a modest benefit, but only to patients who got treated early in their disease with plasma packed with high levels of antibodies.
Others warn that more testing using only randomized clinical trials could confirm real benefits.
Indian researchers in September stated that those who received the convalescent plasma did no better than those that didn't. Way back at the start of the pandemic, we reported to you on the proposed use of monoclonal antibodies. We just talked about the convalescent plasma that was taken from those who had recovered from COVID-19. This plasma contains a mix of billions of different kinds of antibodies.
Some can attack the coronavirus, but the vast majority are directed at other germs. When the pandemic began, scientists began sifting through this slurry of antibodies and picked out a few dozen types to purify and test.
These are the so-called monoclonal antibodies. There was a lot of hope for these monoclonal antibodies. They had a long track record in medicine.
These monoclonal antibodies were first investigated in the 1970s, and since then, the FDA has approved them for 79 diseases, ranging from cancer to AIDS.
Initial studies started in September show that monoclonal antibodies could work best early in infection. Eli Lilly announced promising preliminary data from a researcher performing a trial of over 450 volunteers who were newly diagnosed with COVID-19.
Bamlanivimab was the name of its monoclonal antibody, and it did reduce people's risk of getting hospitalized by 72% compared to a placebo.
Then, on October 28th, Regeneron announced that in a study of almost 800 patients with milder disease, a cocktail of two monoclonal antibodies reduced doctors' visits and trips to the hospital by a pretty good 57%. Unfortunately, the result in more severely sick patients, by contrast, had proven fairly disappointing. Just before this, the National Institutes of Health stopped the trial studying a combination of bamlanivimab and Gilead's antiviral drug remdesivir in hospitalized COVID-19 patients. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Lasky. I have been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office.
We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
We probably all remember that President Trump received a remdesivir antibody cocktail shortly after being diagnosed with the coronavirus in October.
Just after that, Eli Lilly reached a $375 million deal with the U.S. federal government to provide 300,000 doses over the next 2 months and up to 650,000 doses next year, provided that the FDA authorizes the drug. Now, that occurred on November 9th as the FDA granted an EUA to Eli Lilly for bamlanivimab.
However, it was approved with a proviso that it only be used in people newly infected with the virus and should not be used in hospitalized patients.
Have you heard of interferons? Well, these are molecules our cells naturally produce in response to viruses. They stimulate our immune system to attack the invaders, while also reining it in to avoid damaging the body's own tissues.
Injecting synthetic interferons is now a standard treatment for a number of immune disorders, such as multiple sclerosis.
Scientists know that the coronavirus appears to tamp down interferon, and that finding has encouraged the researchers to see whether a boost of interferon might help people weather the coronavirus infection, especially early in infection. And the results, well, at least in mice, has been encouraging. On July 20th, the British pharmaceutical company Synergen announced that an inhaled form of interferon called SNG-001 lowered the risk of severe COVID-19 in infected patients. But that was only in a small group of volunteers.
What happens when the immune system really overreacts to the virus? Scientists are now testing drugs that can rein in its attack.
The steroids such as dexamethasone and other corticosteroids have been used for years to decrease inflammation, and they are also used extensively in allergies and asthma. They've been used as a treatment for pneumonia as well as other respiratory diseases since the 1960s.
With the coming of the COVID-19 pandemic, new interest has been spurred on the use of the steroids as far as a treatment for the coronavirus.
In one study of more than 6,000 people, it was found that dexamethasone reduced deaths by one-third in patients on ventilators and by one-fifth in patients on oxygen. Now, the National Institutes of Health recommends only using dexamethasone in patients with coronavirus, COVID-19, who are on a ventilator or are receiving supplemental oxygen.
Researchers also reviewed the results of other trials of dexamethasone, along with two other steroids, hydrocortisone and methylprednisolone.
And overall, they concluded steroids were linked with a one-third reduction in deaths among COVID-19 patients. President Trump's doctor announced he was receiving dexamethasone along with the other medications that we told you about. So it's really impossible to say just how much this particular one, dexamethasone, helped his own recovery.
The next group of possible cures are the cytokine inhibitors.
The body produces molecules called cytokines to fight off diseases.
The problem is that in excess, cytokines can trigger the immune system to widely overreact to infections.
This is often called a cytokine storm, and researchers have created a number of drugs to actually halt cytokine storms.
These have been shown to be effective against arthritis and other inflammatory disorders.
Now, some of these turn off the supply of molecules that launch the production of the cytokines themselves, while others simply block the receptors on immune cells to which cytokines would normally bind.
And even a few block the cellular messages they send, several are trying out a number of different cytokine inhibitors against COVID-19 in clinical trials.
Unfortunately, the results are mixed. In some trials, the drug tocilizumab has shown some evidence of reducing deaths, but has failed to help in others. There is another called sarilumab, which was basically a failure.
Another drug, baricitinib, which can affect many types of cytokines at once, was shown to possibly improve survival in people with severe COVID-19.
But the studies are not just on medications. They're also studying equipment, such as blood filtration systems. The FDA has granted emergency use authorizations. By the way, that's what EUA stands for, if I didn't say it before. And it's been granted to several devices that filter cytokines from the blood in an attempt to cool cytokine storms.
One machine called CytoSorb can reportedly purify a patient's entire blood supply about 70 times in a 24-hour period.
A number of studies on blood filtration systems are underway right now. but experts caution that these devices do carry some risks. For example, such filters could remove beneficial components of blood as well, such as vitamins and even medications. So in September, a team of experts urged that doctors avoid using blood filtration for the regular treatment of COVID-19. Throughout the past years, we've heard a lot about stem cells, both good and bad. So why not have them used in COVID-19?
Indeed, certain kinds of stem cells can actually secrete anti-inflammatory molecules. Over the years, researchers have tried to use them as a treatment for cytokine storms, and now dozens of clinical trials are underway to see if they can help patients with COVID-19.
And unfortunately, actually I've used that word a lot today when speaking about possible COVID-19 cures. Unfortunately, these stem cell treatments haven't worked well in the past and may not work against the coronavirus. Now, if you are in the military or just a gun and rifle enthusiast, you probably know the term prone positioning. It simply means lying on your stomach.
It seems that the simple act of flipping COVID-19 patients onto their bellies opens up the lungs and often makes the use of ventilators unnecessary.
And therefore, placing patients on their stomach instead of on their back, commonplace in hospitals around the world since the start of the pandemic.
Speaking of ventilators and other respiratory support devices, remember that every person and situation is different. So the rule of threes tells us that we can go without food for about 3 weeks, 3 days without water, and just 3 minutes without air.
So in the case of respiratory diseases, such as COVID-19, there are devices that help patients breathe.
Some patients do well if they just get an extra supply of oxygen through the nose or via a mask connected to an oxygen machine. Other patients may need to have a ventilator breathe for them until their lungs heal.
And although not all COVID-19 patients who go on ventilators survive, the devices are thought to be life-saving in many cases. One of the problems that was found early in the pandemic was that the coronavirus is not just an infection that causes respiratory symptoms. The coronavirus can invade cells in the lining of your blood vessels, leading to tiny clots that can cause strokes and other serious harm. So anticoagulants are commonly used, just as they are in patients with heart disease, to slow the formation of possible clots.
Doctors sometimes use them on patients with COVID-19 who have clots, but there is no clear evidence of what benefits and risks they offer to people with the disease.
Can vitamin and mineral supplements help? We all know that our bodies need vitamins and minerals to work properly.
Some researchers are investigating whether supplements might help against COVID-19, but there is no strong evidence yet that they prevent infections or speed up recovery.
For example, it is fairly well known that vitamin C can help decrease inflammation, but no convincing data shows a benefit as of yet. Remember that it's possible to ingest too much vitamin C, causing symptoms including diarrhea and nausea. Now, vitamin D, it's good for bone health, but it could play some role in helping immune cells function.
Some studies have found an association between low levels of vitamin D and higher rates of COVID-19. The problem here is to determine if this deficiency was the cause of those disease rates.
It may be that populations who suffer high rates of vitamin D deficiency are getting hit harder by the coronavirus for some reasons, including poorer access to health care or underlying conditions like obesity. President Trump was also given vitamin E during his treatment for the COVID infection.
And he was also being given zinc, a mineral that helps proteins throughout the body function.
A 2010 study, that's 10 years ago, on the coronavirus that causes SARS, found that zinc can put the brakes on the replication of the virus in cultures of cells.
Adequate sleep, maintaining good humor, and good nutrition such as fruits, vegetables, grains, and nuts along with the use of antibiotics such as Citromax for secondary infections, are all vital to maintaining good health in order to prevent the symptoms of COVID-19.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.